Hello, welcome along. It's a brand new episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name is Dan. Thank you for being there. You've stumbled upon the smartest show in the history of the universe. And it's been around a long time. Shows you how clever this thing really is. It's a busy one for you this week. We'll head back to the Cretaceous period and the age of the dinosaurs to look at the devastating, terrifying T-Rex.
Quick, another T-Rex is coming.
That's not a T-Rex, but it's still good to hide.
Also, you can find out what a light year actually is with the astrophysicist Paul Sutter.
A light year is the distance that light can travel in one year.
And I've got your questions to answer, as always. This week, they are on sleep and hearing things, also how fish go to the toilet, and we'll talk touchscreens. It's all on the way, and loads more on this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Kicking things off this week with your science in the news. Scientists are trialling a life-saving vaccine for elephants. Now, sadly, there's a deadly disease sweeping through elephants at the moment, and by the time it's spotted, it's normally too late. It's called EEHV, but for the first time ever, experts are seeing if a vaccine for these elephants can stop them catching the disease. Also, climate change is causing plants in the UK to make their flowers a month earlier than normal. Leaves fell in autumn a month later last year than normal because of warmer summers, and warming weather means flowers are popping up even earlier, and this may hugely affect birds and insects who come to rely on them for food at certain points of the year. And finally, the first American-built rover is due to launch to the moon this year. It's been built by students at a university too. It'll go to the moon, drive around, and let experts on Earth see what's happening up there. It's time to jump into a series right now called Age of the Dinosaurs. It's all about the Cretaceous period, and around this time there were more dinosaurs than ever before. It's also where you'd find one of the best known of them all, the Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the age of the dinosaur. Welcome to the end of the Cretaceous period, around 65 million years ago. Around this time, there were more dinosaurs than ever before. The world was crowded with groups of Triceratops, duck-billed Edmontosaurus, squawking birds, and a wide variety of plant and sea life. The end of the Cretaceous period is also where you'd find one of the best-known dinosaurs of them all, Tyrannosaurus Rex.
He's coming this way! Quick, run!
You'd definitely want to run from a T-Rex. His name means King of the Tyrant Reptiles, and he was a terrifying meat-eating dinosaur found in the continent that is now North America. This carnivore was massive at over 12 meters long and 6 to 7 tons in weight. He gouged at prey with his enormous jaws, and his curved teeth made it hard to escape. Despite standing as tall as an elephant, T-Rex's brain wasn't much bigger than a loaf of bread. However, a cast from a fossilized T-Rex skull shows the parts in charge of his sense of smell were bigger than in other reptiles.
Ugh, what's that horrible smell?
That's the smell of rotting meat. A T-Rex could sniff out a carcass from over a kilometre away. It might not have been as tasty as fresh meat, but it was an easy meal.
Quick, another T-Rex is coming.
That's not a T-Rex, but it's still good to hide. That's a Tabosaurus batar, or T. batar. Tabosaurus came from Asia, not North America, but had a lot in common with T-Rex. They looked similar and were both top predators. Scientists think they're closely related, even though they lived on the other sides of the world. Some have even suggested that they might be the same species, but there were differences. Lab tests show that Tabasaurus had a less flexible jaw, so he might have preferred carcasses to hunting wriggling prey. And whilst T-Rex had eyes that faced forward, Tabasaurus had more sideways-facing eyes.
Oh no! I think he's looking at me!
I think he's more interested in that herd of hadrosaurs over there. When hunting, he'd prefer to pick off the old, young, or sick members of a herd. But let's not hang about.
Paleontology. Pick.
The age of the dinosaurs came to an end 65 million years ago. It is thought that a giant asteroid 6 miles across smashed into the Earth, where the town of Chicxulub in Mexico now sits, triggering tsunamis and dust clouds that blotted out the sun. Plants could not grow. Animals were cold and hungry and began to die. From the seas to the skies, many creatures and plants disappeared forever. In fact, 7 out of every 10 species perished. The age of the dinosaurs had gone, and with it 200 million years of the most amazing creatures the world has ever seen. Thanks to paleontologists, we know much about what it was like, but there are many mysteries that remain. Maybe one day, you will make a new discovery yourself.
Let's get to your questions then. If there's anything sciencey that you want answered on this show, dead easy to make it happen, get yourself to the Apple Podcast Store and leave it as a review. I will do all the digging online and in books and figure it out for you. First up this week is from Smilla Addison, who wants to know, why do we not hear things when we sleep? Now, when you sleep, your brain knows that you need to rest. So it does a very good job. It blocks out most noises. It hears them, but it filters them so you don't have to listen. You only pay attention to the important ones. Maybe something that might be dangerous to you, a loud bang or something strange. It'll make you pay attention and it'll wake you up. So you're always hearing things in your sleep, but you're trained to not actually listen to what they are. Also, this is Jude, who is 12. Fantastic question. Do fish wee? Yeah, of course they do. Fish pee. They're living creatures like us. They eat, they take in nutrients and vitamins. That means there's stuff left over, so they have to get it out. They have to wee. Now, some fish push it out through their gills, which is where they breathe. Kind of gross, right? Move on. But their wee is very important, though. The nutrients in it help coral grow, and coral reefs help fish and us breathe. So fish pee is very important for the ecosystem. Thank you, Jude. Lastly this week is from Kitty, who is 11, who wants to know, how do touchscreens work? Get your head around this one. There are two layers in the top of a touchscreen. On your phone, on your tablet, whatever it is. You've got two layers. You've got a plastic one on top and then a glass one underneath. There's also electricity running through it. It goes up and down and side to side. And it's on all the time, and that's what's really important. When you touch the screen, you connect the two layers together, the plastic and the glass. Then that touches the electrical current, which changes the way that it moves. And it knows that. It's like putting your finger on the grid of a map. It affects the electrical current, and the computer inside figures out exactly where it's been touched and moved, so it knows where your finger is. Brilliantly smart, these things. Thank you so much, Kitty. If there's something that you want answered next week on the Fun Kid Science Weekly, leave it as a review for us over on Apple Podcasts. It's Fun Kids. Remember, if you want to send your voice into space, you need to get involved with Mission Transmission. We are sending a radio show right across the universe. And to find out more about what things it might pass on its journey, what's in actual space itself, we're joined by Dr. Paul M. Sutter, who is an astrophysicist. Paul, thanks for being there.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting.
Yeah, we're sending a radio show across space. We've heard little bits about how far it might need to travel before it could perhaps reach life. I think the closest is 4 light years away near a star called Proxima Centauri. Can you just tell us more about what a light year is? How do we define it? How do we work it out?
Yeah, exactly. A light year is the distance that light can travel in 1 year. So I love how this definition explains itself. It's an incredibly large distance because light is incredibly fast. But to give you some perspective, our sun is about 8 light minutes away, which means it takes light 8 minutes to travel from the surface of the sun to the Earth. So if that takes 8 minutes and the sun is really far away, just imagine the distance that light can go in an entire year.
So, as we've said, it would take about 4 years to reach Proxima Centauri, which is our nearest star, not the sun. Further on than that, what might it see along the way? What actually makes up space? Is it all asteroids and comets? What is there?
Yeah, you can imagine this radio broadcast. Radio is, weirdly enough, just a form of light, but we can't see it. But it travels at the speed of light. And this radio broadcast will expand away from the Earth like the surface of a bubble. So if you imagine blowing a bubble and it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, that is the radio waves that will be emitted by this broadcast. And over the course of a few hours, it will travel across the planets of the solar system. So it'll reach Jupiter and Uranus and Neptune. 30 hours later, it will reach the orbit of Pluto. A few hundred hours after that, it will reach the inner edge of something we call the Oort cloud. A year after that, it will finally escape the Oort cloud. 4 years after that, it will reach our nearest neighbor star, Proxima Centauri. And then as the millennia go on, this bubble will expand and expand and expand. It will reach more stars. It will start to see more exotic things in the deeper galaxy. It will start to encounter pulsars and white dwarfs and black holes. It will even reach newly forming systems, nebulae. And will slowly expand. In about 25,000 years from now, this bubble, this message will reach the center of the Milky Way galaxy. About 100,000 years from now, the bubble will encompass the entire Milky Way galaxy. And then millions of years from now, it will reach other galaxies in our universe.
I had no clue that the center of the Milky Way was so far away. 25,000 light years away. That's
exactly
it. Wow. Now
it's a big number.
It's an astronomical number. We know about the sun, and as you said, that's 8 minutes away. The distance that we are from the sun, and then the distance that Jupiter is from the sun and Neptune, is how unusual is that in space? Are things normally that close, or are they a bit further away? A bit further away when you find different galaxies?
Yeah, normally space is so spread out. The places like the solar system are very, very special. It feels like the sun is very far away. It's 93 million miles away, 8 light minutes away. In astronomical terms, that is like your next door neighbor. One example that I like to use to highlight the distances in space is if you were to take the sun and the Earth, which are 8 light minutes away or 93 million miles away, and if you were to place them about 3 feet apart, about 1 meter apart, the nearest neighbor star, Proxima Centauri, in this little scale model that we've just made, where the sun and the Earth are only 1 meter or 3 feet apart, is about 200 miles away. And that's our nearest neighbor, our nearest neighbor.
Now, our broadcast in millions and millions and billions of years, I would imagine, could eventually hit the edge of the universe. We're always being told that the universe is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And that leads us to wonder, the universe is everything we know of. How is it getting bigger and growing into itself? What's the best way you can describe the universe growing into nothing?
Exactly. Yeah, this is definitely something that's so hard to wrap our brains around. But thankfully, this is why we have mathematics. So physics and astrophysics and cosmology, the study of the universe, we rely on mathematics to guide us. Physics and science is a mathematical description of our universe and allows us to understand concepts that we wouldn't normally be able to understand. In this case, the expansion of the universe. Our universe currently, our observable universe, is about 90 billion light years across. It is getting bigger, which means the average distance between galaxies is growing with time. So if you map out all the galaxies at one moment of time in the universe, and then you wait a little bit, and then you map out the galaxies again, on average, they'll all be farther away from each other than they were before. It's normal for us to think of something expanding like a balloon or a loaf of bread that's getting bigger. There's a center, there's a middle part, there's an edge. The edge is getting bigger and expanding into empty space, and then all the stuff in between gets thinned out. That's not the case with the universe. We live in an expanding universe. Our universe also has no center, and it has no edge. We do have an edge of the observable universe, the part that we can see that is limited by the speed of light and the age of the universe. This is the part we can illuminate so far, but there's more universe beyond that. The universe could be just infinitely big, or it could be simply incredibly large, but either way, it has no edge and it has no center. It is not expanding into anything. It is simply getting bigger. And I know that doesn't make any sense, but that's why math is so awesome. It allows us to grapple with these kinds of concepts.
Now, we're sending this message across space in the hope that maybe in 4 years, in 40 years, in 400 years, it might be listened to by other life forms. If you met an alien, what would be the one really important thing you would want to share with them? As an astrophysicist, you've studied more about perhaps their lands than anyone else. What would you like to say to them, Paul?
I would like to say hello. I would like to know what they eat. I'd be so interested in their culture. We'll figure out all the science stuff later. We'll find a common ground for understanding. We'll compare notes. We'll compare our theories of the universe to their theories of the universe. Hopefully they also have a mathematical description of the cosmos, just like we do. And we can compare what we know. Maybe we'll learn something. Maybe we'll teach them something. But I would just be fascinated by how they organize themselves. Do they know about love and fear? Do they feel the same way that we feel? Do they experience the same universe that we do?
Amazing. Oh, such a delight to talk to you. Dr. Paul M. Sutter, astrophysicist all the way from the United States. Thanks for being there.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we look at the most mean and deadly things in the universe. This episode, it's all about the blister beetle. What a name! Instantly, you know what this creature's about, don't you? There are many different species of the blister beetle, almost 8,000 of them. They can be found all over the world, and guess what? They can cause you a lot of pain. They can be dark brown, black with white spots, all sorts of menacing colours in there. Now, like most venomous insects, they're brightly coloured as a warning sign to predators who might be nearby. Because they don't want to sting them, it causes a lot of energy. So they're saying, look, please don't come near, I'm brightly coloured, you know that if you do, I will sting you, and it's going to cause us both a lot of fuss. Now, they make a chemical called cantharidin, which can be used to remove warts. Now, that's not why they make it. It's to make birds throw up. How brilliant's that? Their main defence method. If a bird swallows a beetle and takes in this chemical, it makes them retch and gurgle and then throw the beetle up, hopefully in one piece. It causes them a lot of damage as well. It's what happens to birds, and same to you. Figure out what happens when you touch the blister beetle. You get blisters, of course you do, and they're going straight on our Dangerous Dan list. It's time to get a new series on the show now. This is Professor Hallux, meeting up with him again for the Map of Medicine, where we're learning all about different medical problems. He's here with his sidekick, Nurse Nanobot, and we're learning all about the clever people that help fix you up, help make you better, and where they practice, from the surgeon's theatre to the dentist clinic. And in this episode, we're learning all about medical people and places.
Professor Hallux's Map of Medicine.
Yeah.
Looking good. My map of medicine is nearly complete. You want to know about medical people and places? Anaesthetists, radiologists, dentists, milkmen? You're right there, map. That's not a medical person. Oh, hang on. That's to remind me to ask our milkman for an extra pint. Silly me.
Just delete that out.
And not a moment too soon. Nurse Nanobot, let's open the video phone.
Call accepted.
Hallux's Happy Health Help Desk.
We've just moved to a new town and Mum says we have to register with a new GP surgery. Is this like the register at school? And what's a GP anyway?
I like it when it's an easy one. GPs? Well, they're just doctors. You see them at your local surgery when you've got an earache or a weird, creepy rash. GP stands for green pants because it's the law that every doctor has to wear green pants. All right. It stands for general practitioner, but many doctors do wear green pants. I've got some lovely stuff about GPs and their surgeries. Nurse, can you give us the clinical crunch on a bit of history?
Clinical crunch. Whoops.
Doctors have a long history. From Stone Age times to today and all over the world, for as long as humans have been living in groups, there have been people who've tried to heal others. Until around 150 years ago, you wouldn't need any sort of medical training to be a doctor. You just say you were, and that was enough. That's unless you were a woman, because in most parts of the world, women weren't allowed to be doctors. Unless it was to do with having a baby. What a waste of all those clever women over the centuries. There've always been laws for doctors, and some of them were a bit silly. Like the Roman law, that a doctor would have his hand cut off if he blinded a nobleman. A more sensible law from ancient Greece is still in place today. It is part of the Hippocratic Oath, and it says that doctors will do no harm. These days, GPs have to study and train for many years, so they're some of the brainiest people going.
Good job if they're trying to help you get better. So what happens when you go to see your GP? Let's load up the app and find out more.
Opening the map of medicine.
GPs work at a place commonly called a surgery or a practice. It's not the same as having a surgery or practicing football skills. Just a building, probably not that far from your house. But no football, sorry about that. You're normally given an appointment, which is a certain time to come, like 10:30 or 2:15 p.m. When you go in, you let the receptionist know you've arrived. Sometimes there are touch screens to do this. Then you sit down and wait for your turn. The GP's job is to diagnose what's up. That's working out exactly what's wrong and then to help make you better if they can. They might start by having a chat with you. After all, you're the one who's ill and you can describe how you're feeling better than anyone else. Most GPs have computers where they can see your medical history. There's a list of all the different illnesses you had in the past, so he or she can tell if this is a new problem or an old one. After this, they might examine you. And to do this, he might use some special pieces of equipment. Let's check them out. The first is a stethoscope, like a pair of headphones, to help the doctor listen to your chest. If you're making that noise, then you've swallowed your radio. Normally, they are listening to your heartbeat and sometimes to the sound of your breathing or the noises from your tummy. Next, the doctor might use a flat lolly stick called a tongue depressor to push your tongue down to have a very good look in your throat. If you have earache, he or she might use an otoscope, which is a microscope on a stick used for peering in ears.
Hello.
Another common piece of equipment you might see is a blood pressure monitor. It has a Velcro strap that goes round your arm, which is gently inflated, which might squeeze a bit. Now, it isn't like the armbands you wear when you're swimming. In fact, you'd sink if you tried to breaststroke in one of these. It just tells the doctor about how well the blood is pumping round your body. So these clever GPs pull all the facts together. Your medical history, what you've told them, what they've found when they've examined you, and sometimes questions they've asked your mum and dad too. And the result is... Well, sometimes the GP will have a pretty good idea what's up and will give you some advice or a prescription for some medicine. Other times, they might feel you need to see a specialist for more investigations. That's a doctor who's especially good at one area of medicine. Okay, nurse, let's have, like, a disgusting detail from history before we go.
Disgusting detail?
If you insist. Around the 17th and 18th century, people loved a good travelling show, like a fair or a circus. You'd often get quacks at these shows. Not that sort. People who weren't doctors but who'd sell their homemade pills and potions as amazing cures, like Joanna Stevens' remedy for bladder stones. It was so famous, the Prime Minister even tried it, but the ingredients were just eggshells and soap. Yuck!
You'd have a squeaky clean bladder. Not sure it would help with the stones. That's all for now, but remember to check out the amazing map of medicine. Bye for now!
Alex's Map of Medicine is produced by Fun Kids with support from the Wellcome Trust.
Just quickly before we go, you've still got a chance to send your voice into space. How'd you fancy being the very first human sound an alien ever hears? You can make that happen. We are sending a radio show into space. It's called Mission Transmission. It's a record-breaking radio show, the first one that will travel forever through the galaxy, through the universe. It'll go on and on and on until hopefully aliens hear it one day, and you can be the star. So get thinking. What would you say to an alien if you ever met one? How would you introduce yourself? What would you tell them about who you are, what you like doing, who your best mate is, what your family are like, maybe what you want to be when you grow up? There's space for all of that in Mission Transmission, our radio show travelling forever through the universe. You can find out more and record yourself at funkidslive.com. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening. If there's something sciencey that you want answered next week, leave it as a review for us over on Apple Podcasts. While you're there, so many brilliant podcasts that we make that you can listen to. They're also on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com and everywhere you get your shows. And Fun Kids, we are a children's radio station from the UK. Listen to us all over the country on your DAB digital radio and at funkidslive.com.